Whenever you're ready.
Okay.
Okay. You want to stand? You want to sit?
No, I'm going to stand because I feel like it's like too big of a room to sit. I tried sitting last time. People are like, no, stand up.
We can stand.
Yeah, I'm good. Okay, so we're going to get started. Okay, I have a little bit of a longer introduction than usual, so please forgive me. But I feel like it's important to kind of set the stage before we jump into the sources. Last week, we looked at sources around the topic of Shomer Negiah, premarital physical contact with the opposite sex. And we looked at this issue through the lens of Nida and the prohibition of Lo Tikrivu Legalot Erva, don't come near to uncovering nakedness. Specifically with a menstruating woman, which we discussed is defined as any woman who has once gotten her period and not yet gone to the mikvah. So this week, I want to move away from the question of Nida to a different question, which is there an independent prohibition on premarital sex, independent of Nida? Okay, in other words, what if an unmarried woman were to go to the mikvah so that she is no longer in Nida? At that point, does any prohibition on premarital sex still exist? And here, I just want to say I'm using the term premarital sex to refer to any type of sex outside of marriage, not only for those who have never been married, but also for those who have been married before and are divorced or widowed. But I'm just using that term because it's the easiest term to use. Yeah.
Are we using that term for like all forms of sex or just vaginal sex?
So, okay, specifically what we're going to, when we're talking about tonight, when I talk about sex, it means both vaginal and anal sex. And that's it. Okay? That's the definition that we got last week in terms of the Isur Karet. So that's the definition that we'll stick with. Now, it's an issue which is a contentious one, and it's also an issue which is not purely halachic. And so that's really why I want to give an introduction before we turn to the sources, because I think that there are a lot of social, societal issues, meta-halachic issues, which are influencing anyone who comes to speak about this issue today, whether or not they'll be upfront about it. Whether it's the sexual revolution, the decline of the family, the rising age of marriage, the rising phenomena of non-marriage, hookup culture, the more casual status that sex has attained. All those are part of our reality, which can't be ignored by halacha. And though the tendency of some people, and it could be that some people are here today trying to get a sense of, well, what is the pure halacha? I don't think that there is necessarily a pure halacha. Because part of being honest about halacha is recognizing that there are always many different factors that are going to influence halacha. There's always the lens of the halachist and the particular factors, both within and outside of the halacha, that posek is going to choose to take into account, whether consciously or unconsciously. So, right, the Gemara tells a famous story of an Amora who bragged that he could be Metaher the Sheretz to purify the creepy crawler, which the Torah explicitly says is impure, okay? And he could find, 50 different reasons, 100 different reasons to purify it, which is basically a way of saying that logic and even internal halachic reasoning can sometimes lead us to subvert the halachic system. And that halachists have been aware of that fact since the time of the Gemara. So halacha, therefore, always already involves this negotiation between the text and between the consideration of factors that are not purely halachic. Okay. Before we look at the sources, I also want to mention two topics that we're only going to look at, touch upon briefly, but not delve into. And those are the topic of whether an unmarried woman can or should go to the mikvah, and the related topic of pilegesh, or the halachic concubine. So I really want to just point everyone to several years ago, an issue of the Hebrew Journal Akdamot, 2006, focused on this topic, included the article by Professor Tzvi Zohar that was called Zugiyut al pi halacha lelo chupa v'kidushin. halachic positions permitting non-marital sexual intimacy, which lays out many of the sources permitting the pilegesh, the concubine, as well as several responses to his article from rabbinic authorities and female educators. So for anyone who wants to look at that particular issue more in depth, I would recommend that issue of Akdamot as a great resource. And definitely Tzvi Zohar's article, perhaps other parts of it have also been translated into English. But what I will say is this, not everything that's halachically permissible should always be done. And very often the meta-halachic issues are no less significant than the halacha itself. Very briefly, to touch on the concept of meta-halacha, we have a pasuk in Dvarim which says, Vasita hayashar vehatov, you should do the just and the good, which is something which many commentators talk about, pointing to going beyond the actual law. And there's also a famous Ramban commenting on the verse, Kedoshim tiyu, you should be holy, where he talks about the concept of naval birshut ha-Torah. Literally, someone who manages to be a disgusting person with the Torah's permission. And one of the examples that he gives is the person who eats only kosher food but is constantly gorging himself on meat and wine in a gluttonous way, right? So even though that person might eat only kosher, we still find him to be an unsavory and overindulged person. All right, how does this all connect to premarital sex? Maybe I'll comment a little bit more at the end, but for now, I want to say that I think that there's a difference between premarital sex that happens privately between two people and communally, halachically sanctioned premarital sex. I think that the former can be dealt with much more easily on a personal level, while the latter changes society in a way which might not be for the good. Okay, so that's introduction, and now I want to look at the sources. But because I feel like this issue is so heavily loaded on the meta-halachic realm, I want to work backwards, starting from a late source, which I think puts many of these issues on the table, and then we'll work backwards, working our way back to the psukim, the verses in the Torah, and the Talmudic sources.
What is that,
okay?
What is that meta-halachic? I'm not sure what that means.
Meta-halachic means that there are other considerations other than the purely legal ones. In other words, even if, let's say we start from looking at the psukim, looking at the verses, and looking at the Talmud, we might reach one conclusion that might not necessarily be the right conclusion to reach. So what I want to look at is a responsa that was written in the Tshuvot HaRivash, okay? Because I feel like sometimes if I start from the psukim, we might not get to this responsa, and I think that it is very important, so that's why I want to start there. The Rivash, Rav Yitzchak Bar Sheshet, I'm going to say the 16th century, I'm not even going to say where, maybe it's Italy, maybe it's Spain. I wrote it down and then forgot it in my rush to walk out tonight. If someone else knows, then please chime in. But I think that's the basic time period and place. Writes a tshuva where he really deals with a lot of these issues. We spoke last time about the beginning of this tshuva, and I'll start at the beginning now, looking at it inside, because I think that he manages to bring out a lot of the meta halachic issues, or kind of what are the other considerations that we should think about when asking the question of about premarital sex. Okay, so we'll start at the beginning. Sha'alta leva'er lecha ma shekatuv ba'Torah ve'el isha benidat tumata lo tikrav legalot ervata. Im ne'emar al kol isha nida, bein be'ishto bein be'pnuya, v'im hu kein, eich lo hiskiru davar zeh. Okay, so this is the question that we kind of ended off with last time, very briefly. The question is, explain what it says in the Torah when it says the pasuk that you shouldn't come near to a woman who has her period. Are we talking about any woman who has her period, whether it's one's wife or an unmarried woman? And if so, how is it that the Rishonim didn't talk about this? And he mentions the Ravid and the Rashba, people who have written books on Nida, and he says that whenever they write, they always talk about Ishto, his wife. So does that mean that the category of nida only applies to one's wife? Okay, and he answers, as we mentioned last time, she'isur bi'at hanida lo bi'ishto bilvad ela bein bi'ishto bein bi'ishet chaveiro bein bi'pnuya. Okay, the prohibition of having sex with a menstruating woman applies to any menstruating woman, whether it's one's own wife, one's friend's wife, or a non-married woman. Okay, and he says this is something simple. No one ever really questions it, and it's even superfluous to talk about it. Okay, and now, and this is the third paragraph, he starts explaining what is actually the problem with having sex with an unmarried woman. Okay, and this is the part that I really want us to see. Sheharei bi'ata pnuya asura af shelo bimei nidata. L'divrei harambam zal min ha-Torah. Okay? For having sex with an unmarried woman is prohibited even when she is not in nida. Okay? Even when she's not menstruating, even when she's already gone to the mikvah. According to the Rambam, it is biblically prohibited. V'yesh ba malkot kol shehichina atzma lakach. And she will receive lashes, okay, if she prepared herself for this action. Okay? Meaning, if she prepared herself to engage in promiscuous sex. Okay? So this is the first opinion that the Rivash brings. Okay? We'll see that it's probably not the most mainstream opinion, which is that there's actually a biblical prohibition on premarital sex for a woman who has kind of set herself up for promiscuous sexual relationship. V'harehi bichlal kedesha. Okay, and now basically what the Rivash is explaining, where does this come from? It comes from the concept of kedesha. Okay, we'll go back in a few minutes and look at the psukim to see where the prohibition of kedesha is in the Torah. But he says that this basically gets included in the prohibition of kedesha, harlotry. Okay, even though this woman is not sitting in a brothel at working as a formal prostitute, and she has not, again, put herself out there as a prostitute does to have sex with everyone, nevertheless, one who prepares herself for promiscuous sex outside of marriage enters into this halachic category of kedesha and is violating a biblical prohibition and would receive lashes for doing so. Okay? That's the position of the Rambam, which he mentions first, and I think that he mentions it first not by accident, but because it is really the one position that he can rely on to say that this is the most severe thing, okay, on the biblical level. Everything that he's going to mention from here forward is going to be viewing premarital sex as a lesser prohibition somewhat. Yeah.
Does prepare herself mean mitzvah? Is that what it means?
Right. So that's an interesting question, right? What does it mean to actually prepare herself for it? I think it's a fair reading considering that he's talking about specifically a woman who's not in nida, so that saying that she went to the mikvah and that was a sign of preparing herself would make sense. But he doesn't explicitly say what that is. Yeah.
But maybe he's making a different distinction. Maybe he's talking about someone who plans it, where it's premeditated, versus someone
right.
who like was in love with someone and in the moment and whatever. Like,
then she
right.
went to mikvah.
What?
Then she
right.
would be menstruant by definition.
Right. I hear what you're saying also, which is, when I first read it, I thought that that's what it could mean in terms of she fell into it in the moment, not in a premeditated way, but then that doesn't necessarily work with the issue of nida. In other words, if she's falling into it, then one would assume that she would also be in nida and not have kind of taken the trouble to prepare herself and have gone to the mikvah. Yeah.
I think kedesha implies a designation. You designate yourself for the purpose.
Okay. But meaning designate oneself for the purpose of having sex with this one person.
No, not necessarily. The very act is a form of designation because the halacha says, lo tiye kedesha.
Right.
Which is referring to a certain designation. If you, I mean, he qualifies it as derech znut, which
right.
means that there's a certain designation, a certain mindset, even I think maybe that it'll be implying.
Right.
And you're designating yourself. You're allowing yourself. You're going to that mindset to allow yourself to have promiscuous sex, as opposed to anything.
Right.
But
so
trying to fit into that qualification of the Torah, lo tihye kedei shat, which is a designation. Is it an act or is it a broader, a more involved designation?
Right. Look, I think that these are all questions. It's not, from the text here, it's not clear exactly what that means. I think that as we go on, and especially when we look at the Psukim, when we look at the Gemara, we'll see that there are a few ways of seeing, you know, what is this? What is this type of preparation? What might it look like in terms of how the Kadesha gets defined? But at this point, it's not so clear. It's not so clear yet. That's actually an interesting question. Here, it's on her because the pasuk is lo tiek desha mibnot Yisrael. Okay, that a Jewish woman should not set herself up as a prostitute. Okay, then there's also a parallel lo velo yek kadesh mibnei Yisrael. Okay, we'll see. Actually, according to one commentary, that the man would get punished as well. But I think according to most, at this point, it would just be the woman. Okay? We will see that one reading is that the woman is one thing and the man is the person who has sex with her. But not everyone sees it that way. Okay? Okay. But let's leave this for now. We will come back to look at the Rambam, hopefully, a bit later on. But just to be aware that he's bringing as kind of the most stringent position. And he goes on to say, "Uledivrei hacholkim alav, the omrim she'ein bebiata pnuya lo lav ve lo malkot, mikol makom yesh bebiata isur derabanan." He says, even for those who argue with the Rambam, which is most, okay, and who say that having sex with an unmarried woman does not lead you to violate a biblical prohibition, it does not lead you to receive lashes. Nevertheless, there is a rabbinic prohibition that's going to be violated. Okay, and now he's going to try to explain to us, what is that rabbinic prohibition? Where does that rabbinic prohibition come from? Sheharei gam yichuda shel pnuya asura migzerat beit dino shel David. Kol shekein biata. Okay, so he says, the fact is that there is a prohibition of yichud, of being alone with an unmarried woman, okay, which is a rabbinic prohibition. It was a decree made by the court of David after the episode of Amnon and Tamar, episode where a brother raped his sister, and that rape was made possible by the fact that they were alone together. Okay, so at that point, an enactment was made by the Davidic court, which is still considered rabbinic, that even an unmarried woman cannot be alone with a man. So he says, kol shekein biata, okay? If they can't be alone together, then certainly they also can't have sex, okay? Which is an interesting question, which I don't think that he ever fully clarifies. So is there actually an independent prohibition to premarital sex, or is he assuming that in order to have premarital sex, the couple would be alone together, and so the rabbinic prohibition that's being violated is not having premarital sex, but rather it's the being alone together? Okay? So that's a point that I don't think that he clarifies, okay? But either way, the prohibition is rabbinic in nature. Okay, and then he comes back and says, "Gam yesh mi sheomer sheyesh bebi'ata pnuya isur Torah, af im ein balav velo malkot." Okay, but there are also those who say that having sex with an unmarried woman is a biblical prohibition, even though you don't violate a negative commandment and you don't receive lashes. Okay, so what is it? Vehu isur asay. Okay, and this is what's called an isur asay, which is basically a prohibition that's expressed in the form of a positive commandment. Usually when you have a prohibition, it's expressed in negative terms, right? Do not commit adultery. Do not do X, Y, or Z. But this is something where there's a prohibition, but it's expressed in the positive form, which is ki yikach ish isha ubeala. Okay? The pasuk says when a man takes a woman, and this is the pasuk from which we learn the concept of marriage, okay? And then has sex with her. Amra Torah kshiyirtze liv'ol yiv'ol b'kiddushin. So in saying that, when a couple gets married and then have sex, what basically the Torah is saying is that when a person wants to have sex, they should do so within the context of marriage. So it's not a negative commandment saying don't have sex outside of marriage, but rather we learn from the fact that sex is associated with marriage that it's something that shouldn't be kind of separated from marriage. With me? Okay. And then he raises the concept of Pilagesh. Okay? He's throwing out a lot of different things, but I think that at the end we'll walk away with a certain impression. Okay? V'yesh mi shehitir bi'ata pnuya kol shehi miyuchedet lo levado ve'amru shehi ha-Pilagesh. Okay? And there are those who permitted sex with a non-married woman as long as she's designated specifically to one man. And they said that this is the Pilagesh, this is the concubine of which the Torah speaks, of which the Halacha speaks. The afzu asra harambam lehediot velo hitira ki'im lemelech. Okay? This is something that is a major machloket, a major dispute in the Rishonim. The Rambam prohibits it for a regular person and says that only a king is allowed to have a concubine. Okay? There are others who permit a concubine even to a regular person. Okay? Those others include the Ravid, Rabbeinu Yonah, the Ran. If people are interested in the complete list, Tzvi Zohar, in his article in Akdamot, really goes through all of the sources, showing all of the Rishonim who permit it, and the Rambam's opinion that it's something that's permitted just for a king is really, I don't want to say a dat yachid, it's not that it's only his position, but it is a more minor position. Right. So the truth is, I would say that normally she'd be taken through her own free will. When it's the question of a king taking a Pilagesh or a king taking anyone, the question of will is harder. But when we're talking about a regular person, there is free will. Okay? But there is also definitely something to think about in terms of, from a feminist perspective, whether the category of Pilagesh is really a desirable one or one that, as a woman, one would want to put themselves into. Okay? I mean, we'll see a little bit more later kind of what is the Pilagesh, what defines that category, but a very basic definition would be a monogamous relationship that does not involve kiddushin, betrothal, or nisuin, marriage. Okay? Marriage is a two-step process, betrothal and actual marriage. The Pilagesh relationship doesn't have either of those, but is still a monogamous relationship, at least on the side of the woman, and the truth is today, probably also on the side of the man. Yeah.
Does the Pilagesh have a contract or any sort of legal protection?
Right, that's the thing. No, okay? A married woman has a ketubah, okay? A document which gives her certain rights, which gives the husband obligations, and which gives her financial stability. The Pilagesh has none of those. It really is like a sort of like no strings attached.
Is it like a girlfriend? Like, would you say like in modern day that like, so it's equivalent.
Right, so some people have wanted to say, and this is really the direction that that Professor Tzvi Zohar is moving in, is to say, let's appropriate that concept of Pilagesh and use it for all the people who are in long-term monogamous relationships, say living together, though not necessarily, and say that the women should go to mikvah. They should, the couple themselves should enter into a contract of pilagshut, which is not a document that exists halachically. It's something that the couple would need to invent, so that they could be putting their sexual relationship in a halachic framework. And that's basically, in very brief, the argument that he's trying to make. Okay? I think the argument has several points against it. Again, from a feminist perspective, and even not from a feminist perspective, just as a woman, would one want to put themselves in that type of relationship, which again, it doesn't have a contract, it doesn't have the same guarantees or the same rights and obligations that the ketubah sets up, is a question. It's also a question which he doesn't get into there, because there really isn't a halachic answer of how does one exit the relationship. It's not something with a clear, because it's the whole point of it is that there's no chupah v'kiddushin. There's something kind of informal about it, but at the same time, it must be monogamous. But the questions of how do you enter it and how do you exit it aren't answered. And those are things that we would need to today develop if we wanted to take that concept seriously and if we wanted to institutionalize it in the community. Yeah.
So in terms of the institution of pilagshut, we have to realize that we're dealing with a historical institution, one which isn't applicable today, really, for the most part. The way it functioned, I mean, the Torah, we find pilagshut. And there was a social function, whether it was that the woman was being supported by a man for return for her services, or but it was definitely a institutionalized, it served a social function, which I think today it doesn't. And that also has to be taken into consideration when trying to appropriate it for a whole different type of social reality.
100%.
Halachically, it wouldn't be an issue, but in terms of understanding what the pilagshut actually is, we're dealing with completely different things.
Right. So I agree. Okay? And at this point, let's put those questions aside and move forward in the Rivash. Okay. He then goes on, and the truth is this next paragraph, because I want us to move forward. In the next paragraph, what he basically talks about is the fact that there's no one who will say that premarital sex is totally okay. Okay, and he says, even though people say, oh, this single woman is permitted, doesn't mean that she's permitted as is. It means that she's permitted after marriage. Okay, it means that there's nothing stopping one from marrying her. Okay? And he says, those who want to say that there isn't even a rabbinic prohibition are making a mistake. And he again goes back to this issue of the yichud, of the fact that being alone together, even a single man and single woman being alone together is prohibited rabbinically. Well, then how much more so than actually having sex together? Okay? So let's skip that paragraph and move to the next one, because here I think he starts to go really to the some of the social issues, which again, even though we're now living hundreds of years later, I think it's worth thinking about, are they different today? So this is the paragraph that starts, Umash hukshalacha. Okay, or and that which you asked. Eich hazal, and this was part of the question. I didn't include it in the question since he repeats it here. Eich hazal hinichu shum kadesha ba'olam, shehare einan mitarot atzmam. How did Chazal allow prostitutes to remain in business? Because we know that they don't go to the mikvah. Okay? And this is coming from an assumption that there was some prostitution in the times of Chazal. Anyone who was here 2 weeks ago, we saw the story of Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, who went to every prostitute in the world. There are other stories in the Gemara. There was a story that I brought in Menachos Mendalad. We didn't get to look at inside, of a man who goes to a prostitute. Prostitutes were something that were around in society. And the question is, how did Chazal allow that to happen and not shut the practice down? And he answers, Chalila shechazal yanichu kadesha v'yatiruha. Okay? You know, heaven forbid that Chazal would actually allow prostitution. It's you're misunderstanding, you the questioner. Okay? Ve'af im tiena tovlot l'midotan. Even if they would immerse in a ritual bath, it's still not okay. Ve'hakatuv tzavach lo tiye kedeisha mibnot Yisrael. There's an explicit pasuk that says a Jewish woman should not be a prostitute. V'katav ha-Rambam zal shehi azhara la ulehaba'aleha. Okay, so here, actually, Sefi, this goes back to your question, he actually brings the opinion of the Rambam, who says that it's a negative commandment both for her and for the person who has sex with her. Okay, that both of them are violating it. V'Rambam zal katav v'peirusha Torah shehi azhara lebeitin. Shelo yanichu benot Yisrael lehafkir atzman leshev beinayim al haderech o bekubash al zonot liznot lekol yavo. And the Ramban understands it differently. Hopefully we'll get to look at him also in a few minutes, who says that this commandment, lo tiek desha, that there shouldn't be prostitution, is not a commandment to the specific individual woman or man. It's a commandment to the Beit Din, to the court, or to the leadership, that they should not allow prostitution to happen in society, okay? That they should not allow a Jewish woman to kind of abandon herself to sit on the highway or to sit in a brothel to have sex with anyone who comes. Bo unitzaveach al doreinu she'ein domei yafeh. Okay, he says basically, let us rebuke our generation that is not behaving properly. Ugdolei hador ha'aleim ya'alimu et einehem, pen yikashlu bnei pritzei amenu v'nochriot, v'teitzei esh u'matz'a kotzim v'ne'achal gadish. And he says, actually, the leaders of his generation were pretending to, or were kind of turning a blind eye to the Jewish prostitutes, lest the kind of pritzei, the lewd, the promiscuous Jewish men fall prey to the non-Jewish prostitutes, which they felt would lead to even worse consequences. So we do see that at least in the time of the Rivash, there were Jewish prostitutes functioning, but the way that he explains it, it was not as an ideal, but it was being seen as somehow the lesser of evils. Okay, even though we'll see a bit later on a halachic level, it might not actually be the lesser of evils. It might actually be worse to have sex with a Jewish prostitute than a non-Jewish one. And we'll see a source about that a bit later on. Yeah.
What are the worst consequences?
The worst. I mean, what he writes here is just that, like, a fire will go out, and there will be the description of umatza kotzim v'ne'achal gadish is of a fire spreading. Okay, so what does that mean? What are the consequences that he feared? Was it intermarriage, assimilation? I would assume that it's something in that direction. Okay, that if we have the Jewish men sleeping with non-Jewish prostitutes, then kind of they'll be leaving that inner community, and who knows where that will lead. V'hakadeshot shehayu b'yimei Chazal shelo b'rtzon chachamim hayu. Okay, this is the next paragraph. The prostitutes that existed in the days of Chazal were not sanctioned by the sages. Adarava, okay? It was the opposite. Haytag zera ushmad ligzor alehem kain. Prostitution was brought upon women as an anti-religious persecution. Okay? And he brings a story in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah. Al Rabbi Chanina ben Trajon shegazru al bito leshev bekuba shel zonot. Okay, that they decreed that his daughter would have to sit in a brothel. Okay, and that was part of persecution of the Jews. Okay, but he says nevertheless, mikol makom nir eshe b'yimehem hayu hakdeshot nisharot milashamesh b'yimei nidutan. Kedemash mahatam beperakama d'avodah zarah d'amrale Barte de Rabbi Chanina ben Trajon, Rabbi Meir, Dishtanana. So he says, in any case, in those days, they were careful, the Jewish prostitutes were careful not to have sex while in Nida. And he brings a little bit later in the Gemara, that same story, the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon, one of the ways that Rabbi Meir tried to test her and see, you know, was she actually functioning as a prostitute or not, is that he pretended to be a client. And when he came in to have sex with her, she said, "I'm sorry, I have my period." And he realized from that that she must be saying this to everyone, and therefore she is still okay and is not considered to have engaged in premarital sex at all. But the point of this story of the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon, really 2 points. Number one is to show that prostitution was not socially sanctioned. It was something that was happening to Jewish women as a form of persecution by the non-Jewish authorities. And it was also something where even when it was happening, the prostitutes themselves were observing the laws of Nida. Okay, so if that's something that could be fathomed. Yeah.
Isn't that contradictory what you're saying? On the one hand, you're saying that she was making an excuse. On the other hand, you're saying that it proves that that they were Nizhar.
Right. In other words, the Gemara there sees it as an excuse that she was making, but the fact that the excuse was acceptable shows that it was an excuse that was acceptable, not just for Rabbi Meir, but that people would accept.
Oh, for the men to accept.
For the men to accept. In other words, that if a woman said, "I have my period," the customer would say, "Okay, I'm moving on to the next person." Okay? Okay. We're going to read the last two lines, and then we'll move back to the psukim. Umasha nifleta eich lo tiknu tfila lepnuya kedei shelo yikashlu barabim. Okay, and this was yet another part of the question. Again, I didn't quote it at the beginning because he quotes it here now. How is it that they didn't establish immersion for non-married women in order that people not fall prey to her? In other words, if it's an isur karet, okay, to have sex with a woman who is in nida, then why didn't Chazal just say that all single women should go to the mikvah so that we not have this type of stumbling block? And the Rivash answers, "V'ein kan makom tama." There's no room for questioning here because again, it's really the opposite of what the questioner was thinking. Sharei kevan shapnuya asura. He says that actually it would be the opposite. If single women would go to the mikvah, then they would provide a stumbling block because then people would take the prohibition not so seriously, since the only prohibition on having premarital sex, if the woman is not in nida, it's merely a rabbinic prohibition and not at all at the level of an isur karet, which is much more stringent. So he's kind of saying, better that single women not go to the mikvah and that the prohibition be great, because if the prohibition is so severe, then it will serve as a deterrent for people to violate it. Yeah. Right, it won't really protect. I mean, well, it'll protect her for that week or those 2 weeks. Right. Right. I mean, I hear what you're saying. There is definitely a note. I mean, in the whole rabbinic enactment of the prohibition of yichud, of being alone, there's a very strong note of trying to protect the woman.
Volitionally.
Right. 100%. The reason that I brought the Rivash and the reason that I wanted to start with it is because I think that what we see here, we see halachic sources and we see halachic reasoning, but I think that we also see certain kind of meta halachic sense of the Rivash basically saying premarital sex is not something that he has an interest in permitting. Okay? I think that that agenda that he has, and I'm not using agenda in a bad way, comes out very clearly, okay? And he says, look, you know, you could say that it's biblical, you could say that it's rabbinic, but in the end, he's going to say it's prohibited for whatever reason. And he's going to go further and say, I'm not going to even allow single women to immerse in a mikvah because the immersion itself will lead to a lowering of boundaries that will then make premarital sex much more likely. Okay? Now, again, that's something, that particular point, is a question which we can think about today and ask, does the fact that single women don't go to the mikvah, again, by and large, there are definitely individuals who do, but does the fact that single women as a group don't go to the mikvah lower the instance of premarital sex? Or not? Right? Does it have any impact at all? Right, so I see you're laughing. So in the Rivash's day, I think that this was something that he could say. Today, I don't know, and again, it depends on the community. There are some communities where I could say 100% this reasoning still applies, and there are other communities in which it most certainly doesn't. Okay? Okay. Let's move back to the Torah, biblical roots of the prohibition. I brought one pasuk from Dvarim, chapter 23. Lo tiek desha mibnot Yisrael v'lo yek kadesh mibnei Yisrael. There should not be a prostitute amongst the daughters of Israel or a male prostitute amongst Bnei Israel. Just to mention to you, there are two other places in the Torah where the concept of a zona or a kadesha comes up. One is in Leviticus 19:29, which is a commandment directed at the father. Al techalel et bitcha lehaznota. Okay, don't let your daughter turn into a prostitute, lest the land become full of prostitution. And the other is in Leviticus chapter 21, where we have the isurei keuna, the prohibitions of who a priest, who a kohen, is allowed to marry. And one of the things that it says is isha zona v'chalala lo yikachu. Okay, that a Kohen cannot marry a Zonah. Okay? Okay, but I picked this Pasuk in Dvarim because it's the most explicit, it's really the only place where there's an explicit prohibition on the woman herself, or on the man himself, and it's there that the commentaries talk about, well, what does it mean to be a Kadesh or a Kadesha? Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, are a Zonah and a Kadesha the same?
Right. So I'm using them now interchangeably. I was speaking to someone the other day who was trying to argue that there's a difference between them. From what I've seen thus far in the sources, I've not really seen the source that differentiates, okay, which doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. But, yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't remember the source for that. That was the description right.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
I understand that this is like not taking place in modern culture, but it's a little strange that there's no category for emotional relationships where maybe it's not an exploitation. Maybe people can't get married for some technical reason,
right?
And I don't know, maybe someone's a widow and at that stage in life they're not interested in marriage, but they're interested in having some sort of intimate relationship. And to just categorically place every single sex act that's not within the confines of marriage into these categories seems a little strange, even for the Torah and Halakha.
Right. So the thing is, so I want to say, one of the things we're going to see when looking at the at how Kadesha is defined is we're going to see that it doesn't do that. It doesn't say that any act of non-marital sex enters into this category of prostitution. It doesn't do that. However, the category of what we have today of an emotional relationship that two people get into, or a long-term relationship, that particular category isn't necessarily one that exists halachically. I mean, Tzvi Zohar wants to argue that the category of Pilegesh can be used to define that category. Again, there are others who will argue with him and say, no, the Pilegesh had a very specific meaning as a woman that was really there living with a man, specifically as a sex object and as nothing else. And so how can you use that term to talk about this type of relationships that we have today? It's a question, okay? It's a question, but I don't think that we're going to find any category in halacha that's going to be an exact fit with what happens today. Okay, so what are some of the commentaries in terms of the prohibition of kadesha and kadesh? Okay, so the first is Unkelus. I'm going to run through some of these very quickly just for the sake of time. Okay, he says there's actually a prohibition for a Jewish woman to marry a slave and a Jewish man to marry a female maidservant. Again, these categories of the slave and the maidservant are not ones that exist anymore today. But I want you to see this commentary because, again, just to see a range of how is it that people interpret the concept of kadesha, okay? And it's interesting here specifically that the prohibition is about marrying, right? Don't marry either a female or a male slave. Marriage between a regular Jew and a slave won't work. So the marriage is not actually a marriage. But it's interesting that here the concept of kadesha, of prostitution, is in someone who's trying to marry the wrong person. So just in terms of what that says. The next interpretation is that of Rashi. Okay, Rashi says, Lo tia kadesha mufkeret mekudeshet umezumenet leznut. Okay, given over to, sanctified for, and prepared for promiscuity. Okay, now again, what does that mean technically? It's open. The question of does this mean someone who goes and has premarital sex one time or with one person? I would say probably not. Okay, and we'll see later that specific issue of, you know, is it one strike and you're out? Most people say no, it's not. This is someone who's given over to a certain lifestyle. Yeah.
And given over include money? That's in modern day prostitution. That's what I would think it is. Is that what we're talking about here? Is it prepared for promiscuity or sanctified for that purpose, meaning accepting money in return or accepting an object?
Right.
Accepting, like you do on the marriage story.
Right. Right. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because none of the commentaries here specifically say anything about money, right? Even though, right, with Yehuda and Tamar, we do see money being an issue. Though there's another pasuk I forgot to mention right after this, which says, "Lo tavi etnan zona u'mechir kelev beit Hashem elokecha." Don't bring, right, money of prostitution to the Beit HaMikdash. Again, bringing in money. None of the commentaries here talk about money. So here, what I would say is it's someone who is promiscuous. Does it have to involve money? I don't know. And again, you can then ask, what are the limits, okay? Clearly someone who is having premarital sex one time, I don't think we would say enters into that category, but at what point do we cross the line between it being a one-time thing or an occasional thing versus someone who's totally given over to it? Unclear. At this point also, we're looking at commentaries on the psukim. These aren't halachic texts, so we're not going to see those same kind of limits the way that we would see it in a halachic text. Okay? Just by the way, Rashi interprets the kadesh, the male version, as someone who is prepared for homosexual sex. Okay? So specifically interpreting the kadesh a bit differently. Okay, the Rashbam interprets the kadesha as zona pnuya mina'efet. Okay, a harlot, a prostitute, an unmarried woman who is sexually promiscuous. Okay? What's interesting is the term that's used here is adulteress, like an unmarried adulterous woman. Just felt strange to translate it that way. Okay? Again, is there a difference between Rashi and the Rashbam? They use slightly different wording. It's a question. At this point, really, I'm presenting this range of sources for you just to have a sense of what the commentaries are saying. But I don't know. Technically, is there a difference between these two? Perhaps. Okay? Here, though, what's interesting is that for the Rashbam, the Kadesh is someone who ba'al pnuyot b'lo k'tubah v'kidushin v'lo miyuchadot lo kipilagshim. Okay? The Kadesh is a man who has sex with unmarried women without betrothal, without a ketubah, and without designating them to him as a pilagesh. Okay? Which is interesting, because here you really see the Kadesh as being the very man whom the Kadesha is with. Okay? Whereas for Rashi, the Kadesh and the Kadesha were not having sex with each other, specifically were not. Okay? In Rashbam, the prohibition is on both of them, which could mean it's on both partners in that relationship. Yeah?
Just very quickly, it strikes me in terms of the commentary, not the halachic sources, but all the Shayna and the Rashi, mm-hmm. Rashbam, that we're dealing with a dichotomy between a marriage and prostitution. In other words, that right. category of a committed relationship, which isn't defined in terms mm-hmm. of prostitution or promiscuity, simply doesn't exist.
Right.
And from the ring of the Pshutosh HaMikra, simple mm-hmm. meaning of the verse, it would seem that a committed relationship doesn't fit into that notion of Kadesha. Again, I'm not touching on right. the halachic source. I'm just dealing
right.
with the
right.
literal
right.
meaning.
Right. 100%, which is like what you were also making that point, that the sources are really dealing with these two extremes and not, let's say, what's perhaps more relevant. In most people's lives today. That's true. That's
why
true.
Why does Pilegesh not fit into that?
So Pilegesh could perhaps fit into that in-between category. As I said at the beginning, I don't want to get into Pilegesh because it's a whole other set of sources. We'll see in a few minutes one source that deals with it. We'll see the Rambam and the Ravid. But until then, let's leave it aside. The second to last commentary I wanted you to see on the Psukim was the Ramban. The Ramban, I won't read inside because we've already, the Tshuva of the Rivash has already made reference to it. He says that the commandment here is to the Beit Din, is to the Jewish legal system, that they should not allow this type of society to develop. They shouldn't allow prostitution to happen. Okay? Both on the female side, female prostitute, and on the male side. Okay? For a male prostitute who is having female clients. Okay? And the final source that I brought here on that pasuk was the Torah Tamima, because he raises the question, the pasuk says, Lo tia kadesha mibnot Yisrael, specifically a Jewish woman should not be a prostitute. And he says, Bibnot Yisrael atam muzhar v'i atam muzhar b'knanit. Okay, so he says specifically the prohibition is with regard to a Jewish woman and with regard to a Jewish man, but not with regard to a non-Jew. Okay, and we'll come back to this in the Gemara to ask the question of, is having sex with a non-Jew better or worse on purely halachic grounds? Again, not taking into account the meta-halachic issues that the Rivash took into account, but just on a halachic level, is there a difference? Okay? So let's look at the Gemara. There's a Gemara that talks about the definition of zona. At this point, we'll skip over the Mishnah, and we'll go straight to the Gemara. The Gemara brings a Braita, which has a dispute on what does the word zona actually mean, okay? What does it take to be classified as a prostitute? So the first one, this is Vehatanya, zona, zona kishma, divrei Rabbi Eliezer. So according to Rabbi Eliezer, a zona is literally a zona, okay, which Rashi there explains to me, and I brought you the Rashi below, literally a woman who strays from her husband. So a zonah according to Rabbi Eliezer, is specifically a married woman who is adulterous. Okay? And that there's, in the word zonah, which is a word that's also used, you know, when it talks about Bnei Israel, v'zanu acharei Elohim acherim, that they were led astray, right? You can't be led astray if you didn't have someone to be led astray from. So by definition, according to Rabbi Eliezer, the zonah is a married woman. Okay, Rabbi Akiva omer, zonah zumufkeret. Okay, Rabbi Akiva says that a zonah is one who, translated here as a prostitute, basically someone who is a free-for-all. No, not that prostitute is free, but basically saying that it's someone who is open to having sex with everybody. Rav Matya ben Chiresh omer, Rav Matya ben Chiresh has an interesting definition. He says that basically, even if her husband took her to go to the Beit HaMikdash to drink the sota waters to see if she was if she had cheated on him, okay, from the moment that the husband decides to take her until after she's drunk the waters and it's been proven whether she was faithful or not, he is prohibited from having sex with her. So even if he was taking her to drink the waters and had sex with her, his wife, along the way, but at a time that he was prohibited from having sex with her, he, in that one act, has made her into a zonah. Okay? Basically, someone who has had one act of forbidden sex. Okay? With that being the example. Okay? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, zonah zu ailonit. Okay? Ailonit is a category of a type of woman who is not able to have children. The Mishnah talks about it, what actually is the category. It's not just someone experiencing infertility. It's someone who also, I don't know, the question of her femaleness is somewhat in question. It could be that she has, there are various, whatever, not going to get into it now for the sake of time, but Rabbi Yehuda says that defines a zona when someone enters into a marital relation, even a marital relationship with that person. Chachamim omrim, you know what? I'm going to skip this also. I'm sorry. I just see that we're not going to get to the end by the time we end. I'm going to move to the last, which is Rabbi Elazar. Okay, not to be confused with Rabbi Eliezer from before. He says, "Panui haba al hapnuya shelo l'shem ishut asa'a zona." Okay, and this really, I think, gets the question that the two of you were asking. He says, an unmarried man who has sex with an unmarried woman without the intention of marrying her has thereby made her into a zonah. Okay? Now, in terms of the without the intention of marrying her, okay, I want to just add in, what does it mean to have the intention of marrying her? One of the ways in which betrothal, in which kiddushin can happen, is with sex. Okay? It is something that we'll see in the Rambam in a few minutes, was prohibited after Matan Torah, but if one does it, they will still be betrothed, and then they go to the next step and get married. So when Rabbi Elazar here says, "Panui habala pnuya shelo l'shem ishut asa'a zonah," he's not talking about some amorphous category of a couple that's engaging in premarital sex, kind of on their way to marriage, checking out, are they suitable marriage partners? He's talking about if in the moment of actually having sex that time, it is not being done with the intention of betrothing the woman through that action, then that turns her into a zonah, okay, a prostitute.
Why doesn't he use the word kiddushin instead of
shoot? Right, I don't know. But I think there that it's interchangeable. Yeah.
Do you mean to say that if, say, people are engaged but they're not married yet and they're having some sort of sexual relationship, that does not make her a zonah, even if it's not technically acceptable?
No. So the thing is, engagement today is not the same as halachic betrothal, because today we do both steps of the marriage under the chuppah. But let's say a couple did the betrothal when they got engaged and then was having sex in the period between the betrothal and the marriage, that would not be so bad. Meaning, now, halachically, that's a very funny statement to make. I'm saying it because there's a Mishnah in the Gemara Ketubot, It's in the first few dapim. It's definitely before daf tet. So if you flip through the beginning of Ketubot, you'll see the Mishnah. There was a difference in practice between Yehuda and Galil. And in Yehuda, there was a practice of the engaged couple being alone together and being able to have sex during the period between the betrothal and the marriage. And that was something that that happened there. Okay, now, so that's why I'm saying it's not that bad. In other words, one could rely on the ancient practice that the Mishnah mentioned that happened in Yehuda. Okay, even though it wasn't a universal practice. But again, today, categorically, it's different since we don't have the betrothal anymore. Okay? But the opinion of Rabbi Elazar, okay, is really the opinion which kind of makes that jump and says anything that isn't marriage becomes prostitution. Okay? And that kind of doesn't leave open that space for, you know, what about the in-between relationship. Okay? However, the Gemara in the end says, Amar Rav Amram, Ein Halacha K'Rabbi Elazar. Okay? Amram says, the Halacha is not in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Elazar. Okay? So his opinion is there and is rejected. Okay? So many people, if they want to quote a source of like, where does the Gemara say that premarital sex is prohibited, will quote this source, even though a few lines later, the source is actually rejected as halacha. Okay, what did I want you to see on this Gemara? I wanted you to see one. Actually, I see that it's not actually here. Okay, there's a discussion amongst the Rishonim. I'm sorry that I didn't include it here about. What does it mean, an unmarried man who has sex with an unmarried woman turns her into a zonah? Does that mean that if they have sex one time, she thereby becomes a zonah? Or is it if it's something that happens, I don't know, more than once, more than 10 times, what is it? And there is a discussion of, does one become a zonah at that first time? Okay? What? Yeah, he rejected that as halacha, but what...
Why are we talking about it?
Because I think that it's important to understand, even within the shita of Rabbi Elazar, there are those, and it's most of the Rishonim, who understand him as not referring to a one-time event. Okay? I'm sorry that I don't remember who. It's one of the Rishonim definitely does understand it as, even at the first time, she turns into a zonah. Others understand it as not the first time, but only at some later point. Okay? Okay. Now, I want us to see the Gemara in Sanhedrin very briefly, because it deals with the question of Jew versus non-Jew, which I think is a question. You know, I know that anecdotally, years ago, I interviewed single women on issues of sexual religious conflict, and I still remember one of the women saying to me that she spoke to her rabbi, and the rabbi said to her, you know, if you need to do something, it's better to do it with a non-Jew. And so she had said, you know, the rabbi basically sanctioned her every, whatever it was, going to a bar, specifically where she would meet non-Jewish men. She wasn't having sex with them, but she was, you know, dancing with them, whatever it was, and then she would go back into the Jewish community and date and be totally shomer negia. Okay, so it's comments like that lead me to show everyone the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Pei Bet Amud Aleph, which talks about what is the problem with having sex with a non-Jew. Okay, Ki Atarav Dimi Amar Beit Dino Shel Chashmonai Gazru. Okay, so just at the very beginning, Rav Dimi, when he came to Babylonia, brought this report that the Beit Din of the Chashmonaim, okay, when it says that the Beit Din of the Chashmonaim made the following decree, so it's a rabbinic decree, okay, right? Because if the Beit Din of the Chashmonaim are making the decree, then it has the status of rabbinic, even though it's going to sound very severe. Haba'al hagoya chayav alea mishum nashga. Okay? A man who has sex with a non-Jewish woman is violating four prohibitions. Okay? Nashga is Rashi Tevot, an acronym for Nida. Okay? All non-Jewish women get the status of being menstruating, okay? Even if they're not menstruating at that moment from the fact that they have not gone to a mikvah, okay? Shifra, a maidservant. Goya, a non-Jewish woman. Eshet Ish, and a married woman, okay? Which, let's read the end, and then I'll come back and say just a few words about it. Ki ata ravin amar mishum nashgaz. When Ravin came to Babylonia, he said that, in fact, it was not nashga, but nashgaz. Basically, taking off the last one, which was eshet ish, a married woman, and saying, instead, it was a zona. Okay? He says, Nida shifra goya zona aval mishum ishut leit lehu. Okay? But we don't treat a non-Jewish woman, in fact, even one who is married, as a married woman, because they themselves, the non-Jews, do not recognize the marriage bond. Okay? Whereas Rav Dimi, okay, who said nashga, considering a non-Jew a married woman, believes that the non-Jews do have a concept of marriage and exclusivity within marriage. Okay? It's this topic of sex with a non-Jew is a very big topic. This Gemara is really just kind of the entry point. Where is it spoken about? There's also a parallel Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Lamed Zayin 36, which mentions these same this very same passage. So that's really the key into kind of where it gets spoken about. But what's interesting is that on the one hand, sex with a non-Jew is rabbinic. It's very clearly rabbinic in nature. Okay, the fact that it was Beit Din of Chashmonaim who decreed upon it. At the same time, there is very strong language being used to prohibit it. And, you know, they're using kind of heavy biblical prohibitions in terms of Nida, in terms of Eshet Ish, in terms of Zona, as a way of giving more weight to a prohibition that's only rabbinic. Okay? Now, this might lead one to say that if one had the option, again, on a purely halachic basis without thinking of anything meta-halachic, between having sex with a non-Jewish woman who has not gone to the mikvah or a Jewish woman who has not gone to the mikvah, that the non-Jewish woman would be a lesser violation because it would be rabbinic, whereas the Jewish woman would be an isur karet. Okay, however, I think that the Riva shows us that that's not the only factor to be taken into account. And the question of, you know, what is, let's say, from the man's perspective, what is it going to do to have sex with a non-Jewish woman versus what is it going to do to have sex with a Jewish woman is also a question that needs to be weighed, and not just the pure halachic issue of, okay, you know, this is rabbinic and this is karet, so I'm going to go with the rabbinic, okay? Because it's not that simple, okay? Okay, the Rambam, I'll walk you through really those last couple of sources, because I also, before I end, want to like try to say something to kind of pull this together and also get back to the topic of, well, what does this even say about today, and the types of relationships that we have today, if anything. But just to walk you through the last couple of sources, yeah.
I was just thinking about it. Maybe, you know, we're coming with this perspective that everything that we have today is okay and ideal, and that the Torah should fit its concepts so that they apply to today. But maybe these situations shouldn't exist at all. Like, maybe people who are not married to each other, I'm not talking about people who've already been married, but even like a singles community, maybe people should not be in long-term monogamous relationships that aren't headed towards marriage. And maybe it's better not to have any halakhic category fitted so that it's not sanctioned, so that people eventually have to get married.
Okay, that's definitely one opinion, okay? Great, yeah.
I was just wondering if you could maybe address at the end, if we're thinking about meta-halakhic concerns,
right.
today. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we look at practice, everyone kind of knows that. But there's been no real voices in either rabbinic voices or voices in chinuch that have really tried to put forth any sort of direction to deal with it.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah, no, so... Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let me tell you what sources remain and then try to take just 2 or 3 minutes to say kind of what do I think, which you could take or leave. Okay, the Rambam that I brought is basically the Rambam which talks about kind of differences before the Torah was given and after the Torah was given, okay? And it's there where he mentions the prohibition of the Kadesha, okay? And it's there where the question of the Pilegesh comes in. Okay, so in that Ravid, okay, on the Rambam, there's a dispute about the issue of Pilegesh, okay? We're not going to look at it inside right now. And the other Rambam that I brought, and maybe with that I'll kind of use as a segue to try to answer your question. The Rambam in Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, okay? Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, the truth is I should have translated that phrase, the laws of the principles of the Torah, mentions a really strange law, okay? There's a famous story in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Hei Amud Aleph, 75a, where the Gemara talks about a case of a man who is lovesick for a particular woman, and the doctors say his only medicine is to have sex with her. And the sages say, no way. And the doctors try to compromise. Okay, let her stand in front of him naked. Let them talk behind the fence. And the rabbis just won't hear of it. Okay? And the Gemara there discusses, you know, what was so bad? Was it a married woman? If it's a married woman, we get it. But if it's an unmarried woman, like, he should die rather than just talk to her from behind the fence? What's the deeper reasoning that's at play here? Okay, and the Gemara there talks about a concept of Shelo yu benot Yisrael prutzot ba'arayot. Okay, that Jewish women, even unmarried Jewish women, shouldn't be dragged into promiscuous sexual behavior. Okay, that's the Gemara there, very brief summary. And the Rambam basically brings that as halacha. And he doesn't bring that as halacha where he's talking about forbidden sexual relationships, but he brings it in Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, right? Like underlying principles of the Torah, which is an interesting thing because clearly the Rambam sees this as a meta-halachic issue, that the Jewish society should be one in which Jewish women aren't put into that position of, you know, of having to give over their sexuality, even if it's going to save this person's life. And even if all they're giving over is a conversation. So I bring that because it's strange that the Rambam would bring it there. And again, another thing that's strange about it, which the Gemara even points to, is that it doesn't add up. And I think that that's an important point, that sometimes the technical halachic prohibitions don't always add up to what the decision is going to be in a particular situation. And there... Okay, let's say as a student, you know, who learned the sugyot and whatever, if you were asked the question of, well, what should we do for this lovesick man, okay, I can pretty much say that anyone who learned the Gemaras on that issue would say, well, we'll tell the woman, you know, maybe they wouldn't want to say, well, tell the woman to have sex with him, but they'd say, oh, tell the woman to stand before him naked or to talk with him from behind a fence. It's going to save his life, okay? But yet... the traditional kind of hierarchy that, you know, we do anything to save a life gets subverted here, okay? Because clearly there's some deeper underlying value of a society with sexual morality, okay? So that kind of leads me to some conclusions, okay? One of them is we would be hard-pressed to call premarital sex a biblical violation, okay? It's a rabbinic violation. At most, nowhere near as severe the karet punishment of sex with a nida. Okay? Now, okay, we get to the real question, which is, well then, how do we deal with this question of sex with a nida, right? Is that an insurmountable problem, or should single women go to the mikvah? Okay? Now, again, what I'm throwing out here now are my views and my views alone, really to answer your question, but also to kind of sum up, because we've learned together for an hour, kind of what do I think comes out of it. So I don't think that having single women en masse or institutionalized to go to the mikvah, right, that like at the bat mitzvah, you know, the girl is taken to the mikvah or whatever, not all girls at their bat mitzvah have gotten their period yet. At the time that she first gets her period, there's a ritual, we take her to the mikvah and then she starts going to the mikvah every month, okay? Right, for some girls would probably, you know, in the summer be like past their bedtime to even stay up to go to the mikvah, but whatever, we decree that. I don't think that that would necessarily be good for society. And, you know, is it for the same reasons that the Rivash mentioned? Is it the Rivash's reasons kind of translated into a more modern language? I don't know. But I do think, and this is speaking to those for whom not going to the mikvah would serve as a barrier, I think that for people in that category, it is good to have that barrier, which the immersion removes. Now, for people for whom it's not serving as a barrier, then I think it's obviously different, okay? And basically, I think that what I'm getting to here is that maybe there isn't something that can be said that's going to be true for everyone, okay? People are different. People's backgrounds are different. People's sexual histories are different, okay? But I definitely think that for those women who are not currently engaging in premarital sex, there is no reason to go to the mikvah. And I think that on a social level, it is better to have even a society where many of the women, of the unmarried women, are violating either an Isur Derabanan or an Isur Deoraita of having some form of premarital sexual contact, not actually vaginal or anal sex. It's better that those be violated without saying, well, let's send all the women to the mikvah so that we don't have, you know, kind of those violations happening. For those people who are already having sex, then I would say that as a personal decision to go to the mikvah after seeing the sources and saying, you know, going to the mikvah clearly lessens the severity of what's happening, it does. But I think that that's a decision that needs to be made on a personal level and not on an across-the-board level, okay? One final point, which is I think that Judaism, and maybe is an unpopular thing to say in the current social climate, I think that Judaism does have a value of the family and of marriage. It does. And certain people, I know that I think that Zvi Zohar in his article, but, you know, can you point to something that says that, you know, either that the family is important or that you have to get married or that it's a mitzvah? But I think that some of those types of questions lose a sense of, we do see, you know, starting with Tanakh and going along from there, that there is a tremendous value to marriage and the family in Judaism. And I think that that's a value that we shouldn't lose sight of even for the sake of halacha, which means people are violating halacha. It is happening and has been happening since, you know, time immemorial. But I don't think that the time has necessarily come to say, well, we care so much about the halacha that let's, you know, institute pileyesh or let's have all single women go to the mikvah so that we can lessen the prohibitions that are happening. But I think that in lessening the technical prohibitions, we also lessen the concept of marriage or the sanctity of marriage or the drive to see marriage as an ideal. So what do I think, kind of ending off on the Shomer Negiah and premarital sex question? I think that, and I realize it's a diverse group, and I'm not going to say something that's going to speak to everyone, but I think that every person needs to think within themselves, what can I do at this point in my life to have Judaism be a part of my sexuality? Now, some people might go in the direction of what you commented before, right? Some people might say, look, I've learned the halachic sources. That's it. I'm going to take the halacha and put it into my life with a one-to-one ratio, right? Or take every halachic source that we learned and do my best to observe it. Other people might say, that's not realistic. But what I've seen from the halacha is a distinction between levels of different actions. And I'm going to take on to myself now that, you know, until today I was having anal sex, and starting today I'm going to have oral sex because they're different halachically. I'm just throwing it out there. Other people might say, look, right now it's not realistic for me to take any of these on a halachic level, but I'm going to try to learn other sources. And again, this is not the point of this class, but I'm happy to send my doctorate where I wrote about sexual ethics to anyone who's interested, where I talk about that. I'm going to look at Jewish sources and try to find a sexual ethic that I could take into my life so that I feel like it's not like I'm checking my Judaism at the door the moment that the sexual side comes out. And I do think that if I could make one kind of imperative statement, it's that every person should take something, even if it's something symbolic, to put something Jewish or Jewishly inspired commitment into their sexual life. So that's that. Okay, everyone, free to... I do have one request. Next week, if any the men who are here, and I don't even know if it's a minyan, would be happy to stay at the end and make a Mariv minyan right after the class, I would be most grateful. But I can ask next week. People are willing to.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Do other religions make these distinctions? Meaning, like, let's say you had Islam. Like, is it that there are levels, degrees of prohibitions, or is it that everything is categorically
cleaned out? Oh, that's you.
How do I get a copy of the beginning? Can I get a copy for you? I missed the beginning.
Yeah, I have the technology to set.